Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
What unions are getting at the bargaining table. Meanwhile, another labor board ruling against an Apple store. And today on the show, we check in with the Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO and the Director of UAW Region 2B. Welcome to the Thursday, June 22nd edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Mr. William Samuel, I call him Bill. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.org, national website, will be our first guest on the show today, and we're going to talk about the aftermath of the deal on the debt ceiling. Possible shutdown. Yeah, believe it or not, there could be a possible shutdown. This was one of those last-minute negotiations, and there was a tug-of-war going on. Bill was in the middle of it. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize Act. And yesterday, the Senate Help Committee, that's a labor committee, Health, Education, Labor, Pension Committee, they marked up the PRO bill, which is one of the most significant labor law reforms in modern history. The PRO Act, if it ever became possible, would make it so much easier for workers to form a union. Number one, the number one component, getting rid of state right-to-work laws. Right now, I believe there's 26 states, so half the country is under right-to-work laws, most of them in the South. Bernie Sanders talked about the PRO Act yesterday, and Bill is going to reference that. And what he sees, I mean, this is going to be a tough battle, but you got to start somewhere. You got to start somewhere. That's why elections matter so much. Julie Sue, what's going on with Julie Sue? You know, we were talking about her last week because of the longshoremen. Not a strike, but they were negotiating for almost a year. They finally got a tentative deal. And that was, for the most part, because of Julie Sue. Management called Washington and said, you know, we need some help on this because there's a slowdown, especially on the West Coast. That's exactly where it was happening, Long Beach and Los Angeles, which is responsible with 40% of the goods of this country come through those two West Side ports. They called Julie Sue, and even the management side said, thank you. Thank you, Joe Biden, because she really helped get this deal done. We'll talk about that. Also this week, there's supposed to be a vote. It may have happened already. We'll find out from Bill about a railroad safety bill. And this is all in response to what happened in East Palestine, Ohio, back in February. Rail safety, really, really big issue. And there's another piece of legislation, depending on time. I mean, I got this courtesy of our friends at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. And this is a legislation called Leveling the Playing Field 2.0, which in a nutshell aims to modernize the trade remedy tools that we as a country need to push back against the predatory economic practices of China and other nations. This legislation was introduced by Senator Sherrod Brown and Todd Young. Sherrod, a Democrat, Todd, a Republican. It was introduced in the Senate, and from what I understand, it has bipartisan support in the House. It's interesting to note how many conservatives are lining up. These are, and it's not necessarily them, but if you go back 25, 30 years, the conservatives were all about free trade. And they didn't listen to the union voices about that. Not a good idea. I'm going back to the Clinton days with NAFTA, and they're all regretting it now. Isn't that amazing? So Bill's going to be our first guest. Later in the show, we're going to check in with David Green. David is the director of Region 2B of the United Auto Workers. That encompasses all of Ohio and all of Indiana. A little background on David. He became a UAW Local 1112 member back in 1989 when he was a summer helper at the GM Lordstown Assembly Plant. That's a story in itself. That plant has one heck of a history. You may recall the Chevy Vega. That was the first car that came out of Lordstown back in the, late 60s, early 70s for sure. And then you had the Cobalt, the Chevy Cruze. They had three shifts running there. And now it's all dried up, all dried up. Getting back to David, 6 years after 1989, he hired into General Motors' fab plant, where he worked in various capacities, including general assembly, material handling, body shop, press room. 2003, he was elected to his first position as trustee for Local 1714. Had that position until 2006. Later elected vice president. Served as president of the local. The two UAW locals representing members at Lordstown Complex, that's 1112 and 1714, merged back in 2018. And David was sworn in as president of Local 1112. 6 months later, after he assumed the role, GM announced they were closing that plant. I remember that day. That was a sad day. With that closure, he left for GM's Bedford casting operations in Bedford, Indiana. That's where he joined UAW Local 440. And there he started as a die cast operator, later became a hot metal driver. He was asked by the local leadership 3 years ago if he can act as an alternate health and safety rep. A year later, he was asked to function as temporary representative while the plant was transitioning. He's got some good education, too. He's got a bachelor's in social sciences from Youngstown State University, a master's in organizational leadership from Geneva College, also a graduate certificate in instructional communication from Youngstown State. A couple things that we're going to talk about is, number one, organizing. Always got to talk about organizing. We'll talk about Lordstown. There was a strike at Clarius. We'll get into that. And we'll talk about the UAW priorities going forward. So he brings a lot to the table. And again, we're proud to have the UAW as sponsor, one of our many sponsors right here on America's Workforce. Now a brief look into the world of labor. This segment brought to you by the good folks at Boyd Watterson Asset Management. $17 billion in assets under advisement. For the first time ever, this is pretty significant, union negotiators have secured an average first-year pay raise of 7%. Think about that. I mean, over the years, you are lucky to get 1%, 2%, 3%, you know, in certain steps. Well, we got inflation to deal with, but this is pretty significant. This average makes the eighth straight quarterly increase in pay raises negotiated in union contracts. Now, some are worrying that this increase could cause employers to drag their feet in the hundreds of workplaces that have unionized but have yet to ratify their first contract. However, for most represented workers hoping to keep up with inflation, the pay increases are definitely, without a doubt, a significant win. We also have a win out of the NLRB. A judge ruled that Apple violated its New York store employees' rights by interrogating workers about their legally protected activity with the union. The judge held that Apple must cease confiscating union literature and interfering with employees' exercise of their rights. However, Apple's actions against their workers and union activity had already halted the organizing campaign by the case's first hearing in January. So a lot of the workers are already intimidated, and that's exactly how this is designed. Meanwhile, according to the Washington Post, only 13 out of the 49 Starbucks baristas across Buffalo, New York, who were part of the initial efforts to unionize, are still working for the company. One of the baristas is Lexi Rizzo, shift supervisor who signed the initial letter that was sent to Starbucks CEO in August of 2021 that let him know that the baristas were seeking to form a union. The Post reporting dives into the retaliation that Lexi has faced following her advocacy. The union drive at Starbucks was significant for a number of reasons, largely because it inspired similar union drives in retailers like Apple, REI, Chipotle, and Trader Joe's. Moreover, today only 6% of private sector employees are part of a union, so these efforts to unionize in low-wage service jobs represent a new and expanding front for labor. And, of course, the efforts have been met with fierce resistance from the companies, and Starbucks has been found to have retaliated against union supporters by increasing surveillance, firing them, and promising better pay and benefits if the workers reject an organizing campaign. So if you want to read more about that, you might you got to get a subscription to the Washington Post, but they have introductory offers there. But they followed her journey, and it's not a pretty one. Not a pretty one. New York City announced last week that it has reached a tentative contract agreement with the Uniformed Officers Coalition, which includes unions representing 32,000 members across the fire department, the police department, corrections, sanitation departments. Mayor Eric Adams announced that the five-year deal, that's pretty good, will cost the city about $4 billion. And includes annual salary increases between 3.25% to 4% over the next several years. And Adams said, we have a quote here, they went through a lot over the last few years. We want to make sure that we are there for them and state that we support them and continue to stop the hemorrhaging of city employees and show the attractiveness of working in city government. The announcement comes just 2 days after Adams announced a tentative deal with the United Federation of Teachers. So it's good to see that they signed off on that. Boy, he makes a good point, though. There are so many people that are leaving their professions, especially the frontline workers. And this is all, again, related to the pandemic. One more here before we break. Last year, when railroad unions planned to go on strike to push for paid sick days for their members, Congress and President Biden intervened to block the strike and impose a deal that provided no paid sick days. Yeah, a lot of people upset about that. Well, how about this? Fast forward to today, 6 months later, according to the Wall Street Journal, 57% of all unionized rail workers have paid sick leave agreements. Three companies have reached deals with unions that give crews more predictable rest schedules. One new schedule would ensure that railroad engineers work no more than 4 days in a row and get four consecutive days off in a 15-day period, while another has six work days followed by two rest days. The agreements have come under continued unrest among rail employees, public pressure from union leaders and politicians to improve the quality of life of the workers, plus there's complaints about poor rail service. According to Jeremy Ferguson, Jeremy is the president of the Transportation Division of SMART, that's the International Association of Sheet Metal, Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers. He pointed out the toxic cultures at railroads had become more and more visible, and it was clear that it was time for a change. And that change is finally happening. All right, quick break. Bill Samuel on behalf of the AFL-CIO coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans. And we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers. And we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO. America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Auto Workers. Find more at UAW.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this next segment brought to you by the North Coast Labor Federation.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
America's Workforce is presented by the Laborers International Union of North America. Feel the power right now at liuna.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Real simple, AWF Union Podcast, AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this portion of the show, sponsored by iMed, switching to managed vision care may save your fun money and deliver a better experience. All right? Save money, better experience. So do this. Go to imed.com/union and you will learn a whole lot more. All right. Let's go to Washington. Always enjoy talking to this gentleman, Mr. Bill Samuel, who is the Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. And, of course, he was in the middle. He's always in the middle of something. And we had this debt showdown. And, you know, when we think all these things are done, well, it's not the case. We may see a government shutdown. Bill Samuel, what the heck is going on with this showdown?
Hey, well, it's been a wild month since the last time we talked. You know, Kevin McCarthy led his Republicans to pass a $4 trillion cut in federal spending over the next 10 years. This was their extortion to get an increase in the debt ceiling. Now, you know, the debt ceiling is just paying old bills. Every so often the government has to raise the debt ceiling so that we can pay bills that we've already incurred. That's been done, you know, dozens and dozens of times under Democrats and Republicans. It's not usually that big a deal. But McCarthy decided to use the threat of a default on the debt to insist that Democrats vote to cut spending going into the future by about $4 trillion. Every program would be cut by 20-25%. We're talking about law enforcement, healthcare, education, you name it. So Biden and McCarthy sit down in the White House and they negotiate over a period of weeks. Obviously, we can't afford a default on the debt. That would cause a international crisis, economic crisis. So We were worried, frankly, what is Joe Biden going to agree to avoid this default? Is he going to agree to a $4 trillion cut in spending? All the programs that we care about are bread and butter of working families. He got the best of Kevin McCarthy. It was really quite stunning. People reported on this, that McCarthy agreed to increase the debt ceiling, so we didn't have that hanging over our heads, and basically keep funding at the current rate for the next 2 years. That was his deal. Mm-hmm. Republicans were furious at McCarthy for signing this deal. So that all happened in the beginning of June, just a few weeks ago. A lot of reporting on that. We were pretty pleased. The president showed his mettle. McCarthy showed that he couldn't really lead his caucus. There were threats to kick him out. The extreme element of the Republican House caucus shut down the House for a week. They wouldn't pass any legislation at all to punish McCarthy. Things that he wanted and they wanted, they decided to make an issue of it and shut down the House so they couldn't vote on anything. In any case, and then about a week after that, now we're into last week or just the week before, McCarthy reneges on the debt ceiling deal. He says, in fact, we're going to start passing annual appropriation bills starting this summer, and we're going to go back to this idea that we're going to cut trillions of dollars in spending. Oh, by the way, all on domestic spending. You know, like I said, law enforcement, healthcare, education, science. He would keep funding the Defense Department, but all the cuts would fall on, you know, basically programs that help working people. So that's now we're back into this, mutually assured destruction, where we may have a shutdown at the end of the year. The current funding bills that are in place, passed last year when the Democrats were still in charge, they expire at the end of this fiscal year. That's the way things work. Everything goes for 12 months, and then you have to redo it all. So by the end of September, we've got to pass all these annual appropriation bills. And McCarthy is saying, "What that deal I agreed to? Forget it. we're going back to the annual cutbacks that, again, over 10 years would equal about $4 trillion, 20-plus percent in all the domestic programs. And we're going to pass the first increment of that this summer. And I think we are barreling toward a shutdown because Democrats will not agree to that, as they shouldn't. And we'll see what happens. Now, McCarthy blinked last time, as I said. He blinked when the debt ceiling was the issue. Now we're going to have a government shutdown threat at the end of September. And I got to believe he's going to blink again, because government shutdowns always look bad for Republicans.
Yeah.
You know, the American people just don't believe the Democrats are really into shutting down the government, and they're not.
Yeah.
We'll see. We'll see who blinks first. I think it'll be Kevin McCarthy, but, you know, nothing's for sure here.
The perception is that when you shut down the government, you save money, and that's so far from the case. I remember when Trump shut it down, it was like 35 days, and
right.
It cost literally millions, if not billions, to start everything up again.
Right. And shutting down and starting back up costs a lot of money. You lose revenue, and, you know, not to mention the disruption. I mean, everything from closing national parks to failure to send out federal paychecks. You can't pay customs and border officials. You can't pay airport screeners. I mean, it really is chaotic, and it does, as anybody who runs a business knows. It costs money to interrupt operations like that, and then you just look foolish. And it always ended. The last 30 years have been a few government shutdowns, I think maybe three that I can remember. And the Republicans always get blamed for it, because I think, understandably, the American people believe that if anybody's going to shut down government, it's going to be Republicans, because that's not – Democrats are more responsible than that.
Yeah.
So, again, we'll see. I think Joe Biden has proven, you know, despite his age and the number of years he's served in government, he is one tough cookie, and I think he's not going to back down. I think Kevin McCarthy is.
Yeah, all those years in the Senate have definitely seasoned him. Now, I have to ask you, again, are we talking about a minority here trying to speak for the majority of Americans? I'm referencing the Freedom Caucus. There's not too many of them that are really, really driving Kevin McCarthy on this issue, right?
Well, you know, he's got a 4-vote cushion in the House. Remember, you know, the last election was very close. It turned out much better for Democrats than was predicted, although they still lost control of the House. So McCarthy can lose, I think, 4, maybe 5 votes in his caucus, and then the Democrats are in charge. You know, it's the margin is that tight. So it doesn't take you look around the Republican caucus, there are way more than 5 extremists. In fact, by the way, the Freedom Caucus you mentioned, I guess it's the Republican Study Group. That's a little more moderate, very conservative. It's not the Freedom Caucus. The Republican Study Group has about 150 Republican members. Last week, they called for raising the Social Security retirement age. Very, very, very unpopular with the American people. Mm-hmm. A wrong-headed idea, something, you know, conservative Republicans have always supported. They claim they support Social Security, but actually they want to weaken it. So a pretty big portion of the Republican caucus is very conservative. Now, you're talking about the Freedom Caucus. That may have 30 or 40 members. Can't remember the exact number. They are extremists. That's the Lauren Boberts, Marjorie Taylor Greens, Andy Biggs, Matt Gaetz. You've heard of some of these people. They're the ones who want to impeach Biden, impeach the head of the Department of Homeland Security. They want to go after Hunter Biden. That's a smaller group. But when you can only afford to lose 4 or 5 votes, and then you lose control of the House, 30 or 40, and remember, he took him 19 ballots to become Speaker. I think at that point, there were about 12 who were holdouts until the end. So he has no margin for error. I mean, you got to feel for the guy. I don't think he's that bright. But McCarthy has a very tough job to stay in power. And there's my belief, he's not going to be Speaker at the end of this Congress. He's not going to be able to hold on, I don't think.
Yeah. We talked about raising the Social Security on our Friday show with the Rich Fiesta. You know Rich from the Alliance.
Sure, of course I do.
Yeah, Alliance of Retired Americans. And, they're all fired up on that whole issue. What gets me, there's ways to strengthen Social Security, but nobody's talking about that, like raising the cap, scrap the cap. I don't get that part. Why? Yeah, because if you go back 40-plus years when Reagan was in office, you'll remember what they did with Social Security, because we went through the same type of thing. I mean, we got a changing population. You got a lot of people retiring. I get it. So why can't we get both sides to sit down together and work things out? I guess that kind of stuff just doesn't happen anymore in Washington, does it?
Yeah, the idea of a Social Security Commission or Blue Ribbon Panel, something like that, I'm not sure this is the right environment to do that in, because the Republican Party is full of so many very extreme conservatives who don't really believe in Social Security or Medicare. You know, the Republicans, back when these programs started, by and large, didn't vote for them, and they've been critical of them ever since. They think it's, borders on socialism. Now, they won't say that in front of an audience of voters, but that's what they believe.
Right.
As I said, a pretty significant number of them want to raise the Social Security age, despite the fact that we're not living as long. You know, if you look at the longevity statistics, Americans are actually, the life expectancy is actually going down for many categories of Americans. Our health is getting worse. We have more suicide, drug addiction. I mean, things are not great in terms of our health. So the idea that we're going to make people work longer, many of whom are in very physically demanding jobs. We're not all sitting at desks. We're behind microphones. Your listeners obviously know that. So the idea of raising the retirement age, they suggested that in France. You may have, I don't know if you reported on that. There were riots in the streets for weeks. I think it was going from 62 to 64, I think.
Right.
So anyway, not a very popular idea. So a Blue Ribbon Commission, if it's, equal number of Democrats and Republicans, I'm not sure it's going to come out with the right solution. You put your finger on it, though. Bill Gates, the amount of income that he pays Social Security on is the same as you and I pay. Is it, $117,000 now? When you get to that...
Oh, it's up there now. I think it's $160,000.
Oh, is it really? Okay. Over the years, it's gone up every year. So when you get to that point, you stop paying Social Security taxes on your... Well, Bill Gates, that's his first paycheck,
right.
Or Jeff Bezos. And then they stop paying in. So it's
Wait a minute. Stop right there. That's the first hour in the new year for Bill
Gates. Okay, the first hour. Yeah, I mean, maybe, if you're making $10 billion a year, you get there pretty quickly. So, right, we should raise the cap. And it doesn't have to go unlimited. We're not saying that Jeff Bezos has to pay, 7.5% on every dollar he makes. I don't see why not, but that might seem like a lot. That would be millions. It's several hundred million dollars, I guess, that he'd be paying into the Social Security system, which would be progressive. I mean, that is how our tax system works. But you could cap it at maybe $400,000, I think that's the current proposal among progressives in the House, is to raise the cap from, I think you said it was $160,000 to $400,000. The first $400,000 you'd pay 7% for Social Security. And that would wipe out the Social Security deficit, which is, by the way, not really a real thing because it's a pay-as-you-go system, almost overnight. But Republicans don't want to do that because, A, they don't really believe in government, and they want to leave rich people alone. That's just a fact of life.
Yeah, good point.
They don't want to touch them. Yeah.
Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director for the AFL-CIO, national website, AFLCIO.org. Lots more to talk about. We're going to get into a Julie Sue getting confirmed there. That's a tough one. The PRO Act, the markup in the Senate, pretty significant. We'll get into that. Later in the show, we're going to check in with David Green, who is the UAW Region 2B Director. That's all of Ohio, all of Indiana. Back in a few minutes. You're listening to America's Workforce.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA. Americaswork.org.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers. You can find more at ifpte.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, where you can find more at teamster.org.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
You're listening to America's Workforce, and this upcoming segment is brought to you by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. Check them out online at oft-aft.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis. And give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings. We're getting more of those, and keep them coming. Well, all right, let's go back to our live line. Rejoin Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. Julie Sue, I was talking about her last week with the negotiations and the longshoremen on the West Coast, and I know she was a key figure. I figured, and I'm sure you as well, that would knock her up a few points here in the Senate to get her confirmed. Are we making any progress on that, Bill?
You know, we are very close. Julie Sue, who deserves to be confirmed as Labor Secretary based on her long career defending workers, enforcing federal labor laws, both in California when she was Labor Secretary and then for the last several years as a deputy under Marty Walsh. And Marty Walsh is a big supporter of Julie Sue. I think she is still one vote short. I think she needs one more vote to be, a confirmed vote before she can make it across the line. And, I mean, I think people may or may not know this, but that one vote is Kyrsten Sinema. She was a Democrat from Arizona. She's now an independent senator from Arizona. If she will confirm that she will vote for Julie Sue, if she will announce and make sure that Chuck Schumer can be certain when he calls the vote that Kyrsten Sinema will vote with Julie, she'll have enough votes to become Labor Secretary. But Kyrsten Sinema has been playing hard to get, and this is kind of how she rolls. She often doesn't tell the leadership how she's going to vote on something, and they have to sometimes roll the dice. But when you're dealing with a nomination of a key cabinet official, you don't want to roll the dice going into the vote. So I check in every week, others do as well, with the Senate leadership, and they're kind of waiting for Kyrsten Sinema to decide. And she's, I think she's in a negotiating posture with the White House. She's trying to get whatever she wants to get for either for her state or whatever her making her hard to get. And we'll see. Poor Julie Sue's been hanging out there for several months. She went out to the West Coast. She helped negotiate a deal that settled that strike. She shuttled back and forth between the employers and the union, which, is the job of a labor secretary. I think she proved her mettle. She deserves to be labor secretary, and we're going to keep putting pressure on Sinema and the rest of the Senate to take her up and confirm her.
Yeah, she got high marks from the, I believe it's called the Pacific Maritime Association, something
like that.
That's
right, the employer group and the L.A. Chamber of Commerce. She actually got this. Democratic labor secretaries don't normally get endorsed. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce has stayed neutral. I think all the signs point to this, to Julie Sue being the right person for the job at the right time, and we just can't nail down that last vote. It's very frustrating. I feel bad for her. I feel bad for the Senate leader and Joe Biden, who wants to have a full cabinet, and the labor movement needs a labor secretary.
Yeah.
She's acting now, but that's she's kind of constrained. When you're an acting cabinet official, you don't have all the power that you need to really enforce the law and pass new move new regulations through the system. So we're all hurting because of this indecision by Kyrsten Sinema. If folks know anybody in Arizona, if you've got relatives out there, get on the phone and try to push Kyrsten Sinema over the line.
Now, Bill, Joe Manchin is a clear no on Julie Sue. Is that right?
We think he is. He's been a little bit hard to pin down, but I think he sent all the signals that he's a no. Which, just to remind folks, we have 51 Democratic senators, 49 Republicans. Obviously, Julie Sue will need 51 votes or a majority. So if Joe Manchin's a no, it's 50-50, at which point the vice president breaks a tie.
Right.
So Kamala Harris will drive down Pennsylvania Avenue. She'll cast the 51st vote. And by the way, that's happened a number of times because we have not been able to count on Republicans. And once in a while, we've lost Joe Manchin on a key vote. But we can't afford to lose a second Democrat. That's why Kyrsten Sinema becomes key. Now, if we can turn Joe Manchin around, Kyrsten Sinema doesn't matter as much. But I think given his reelection coming up this next fall, he doesn't want to appear to be too close to Joe Biden. It's a state that went for Donald Trump by a huge margin. We have issues with Joe Manchin, but, he's got his politics to worry about. I don't think Kyrsten Sinema has the same justification. I think she's just holding out to see what she can get for her vote for Julie Sue. And plus, she's, every week she becomes closer and closer to the business groups in Arizona because she's now an independent. She's not counting on the Democratic Party to renominate her. And that's, I think, changing her political outlook.
Those of you listening in Arizona, contact Kyrsten Sinema. We got to get her vote on Julie Sue. And you can also go to the AFL-CIO website and add your name because they're trying to get as many names to push this over the top. AFLCIO.org, the homepage, it's right there. All right, PRO Act. Something significant happened yesterday in the Senate. Talk to me about this.
So we're gonna end on very good news. The Protecting the Right to Organize Act, landmark legislation to make it easier to organize, to make it fair, to end captive audience meetings, to protect against striker replacements, to have real penalties for companies that violate the law, to fix the problem of misclassification. I think we've talked a lot about the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. It was reported favorably out of the Senate Labor Committee. It's the first time the Senate Labor Committee has considered and passed comprehensive labor law reform in 30 years. Came out of the committee. There were 38 Republican amendments. All were beaten back. Democrats remained united. And by the way, they only have a one-vote margin on the Labor Committee, as they do on similarly to the margin on the Senate floor. Democrats held together, reported it out favorably. It's now headed for the Senate floor. Now, I've got to be honest with you, probably not going to pass. Republicans will filibuster the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. Takes 60 votes to end a filibuster. There are only 51 Democrats. So even if every Democrat votes for it, and we hope they will, I don't think we're going to get 9 Republicans. So it'll take another Senate election, cycle to maybe get to 60 or to get enough Democrats to change the filibuster rule. In the last Congress, we came very close. And just going back to our last conversation, the two Democrats that held out against change and getting rid of the filibuster, Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema. you can change the filibuster rule. This is kind of odd. With 51 votes, you can change the Senate rules with a majority of 51. The two of them wouldn't go along to get rid of the filibuster. So it's still in place. The Republicans can still block almost anything. And they will block the PRO Act when it gets to the floor. By the way, the House has passed it twice in the last two Congresses. Now, under Kevin McCarthy's Republican leadership in this House, they won't even take it up. So it's not going to happen in this Congress, 118th Congress. But in the next Congress, in the 119th Congress, if we take back the House, we get enough Democratic senators to change the filibuster rule, we can pass the PRO Act within the first couple of months of the 119th Congress. So that's what I'm looking forward to.
Again, a minority making calls for the majority. Yep. It's amazing, just amazing. Right. And you know what's really amazing too, Bill? If this ever happens, I mean, half the states in this country are right-to-work states. I think it's 26 right now because Michigan is bailing out now.
Right.
But do you imagine what that would do to union membership?
Yeah, I didn't mention that protecting the right to organize also eliminates right to work, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
As you said, in 20-plus states, it would no longer be the law in those states. And, I mean, this really it would fix a lot of the problems that have developed over the years. And we haven't changed the National Labor Relations Act for the better since 1935 when it passed. There have been two major amendments, 1947, 1959, weakened it over those two big amendment cycles. We're now in the 2023. It seems like it would be time to modernize and strengthen the foundational labor law in this country with all the changes in business and our economy. So it is time. It's long past time. So we in the labor movement, as your listeners know, we played a long game. Mm-hmm. So we're going to keep this fight up until we do it.
Amen.
Until we get it passed.
Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. Again, the national page, AFLCIO.org. You take care. Enjoy the 4th of July holiday weekend, which is right around the corner. We'll talk to you later in July.
Okay? Thank you, and you too.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. David Green is the UAW Region 2B Director, and it sounds kind of weird, 2B Director, Region 2B. He's coming up next right here on America's Workforce.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the United Steelworkers. You can find more at usw.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America. You can find more at cwa-union.org.
You'd like to upgrade your fund's vision care, but you need to roll back the clock on the cost. Roll it back to the 70s. iMed offers members 76% average savings versus retail on eye exams, glasses, and contacts. Enjoy similar benefits to an indemnity plan, but with consistent savings and a better experience. Endorsed by the National Labor Alliance, iMed takes a consultative approach to tailor your vision insurance benefits. Learn more at iMed.com/union. Figures based on client data. Visit iMed.com/union for more details.
America's Workforce is brought to you in part by the Heat and Frost Insulators Labor Management Cooperative Trust. Find out more at insulators.org/LMCT.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Real simple, AWF Union Podcast. All right, let's go to line number two right now and join David Green. David is the director of Region 2B of the United Auto Workers, and we're talking all the state of Ohio and all of Indiana. You put them all together with those that are retired and active, we're talking 160,000 members. That's a chunk. That's a chunk right there. David Green, welcome to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today. I read about you at the beginning of the show and your history at Lordstown. Boy, I tell you, I'm a Northeast Ohio native, and I followed that plant from day one. The Chevy Vega. And that was, you were telling me off the air, how many Vegas did they crank out in an hour at Lordstown at that time?
They were pushing out 100 Vegas an hour, which is really unheard of and created a lot of strife at that plant, right? It's the human body is not made to produce like that.
Wow. Wow. By the way, David became a local 1112 member back in 1989. When he was a summer helper at the Lordstown Assembly Plant, which is now closed. I mean, boy, things have changed. I remember when they were doing the cobalt there, they had, was it, or maybe those, the Chevy Cruze. I think it was the Cruze. they had three shifts going there, and then it just all kind of dried up. Very sad situation. But let's talk about your territory here. 160,000 members and a number of locals. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, I've got represent about 120 different locals through the two states, and each local has multiple units, some as many as 40, some others just two or three units, but there's 320 units associated with those 120 locals. So, you know, that means there's 320 chairmen and 320 contracts. And so there's just always a lot of work to do, making sure that our members at those units and locals are getting the right representation.
Right, right. You know, I was just talking about the UAW a couple of days ago on the show because your president, Sean Fain, is getting ready for September. They're talking a possible strike against the Big Three. Is that pretty much a tactic saying, hey, you know what, let's get to the bargaining table right now. We got a lot to discuss. Is that kind of where we're going with all of this?
We've given up quite a bit, and the corporations have made enormous amounts of profits over the last, you know, decade or longer. So it's time that our members get their fair share. Sean, I think you're going to see a more progressive UAW moving forward. We just came through a direct election, one member, one vote. So we've got a lot of new leaders, new folks in, and we're really trying to change the direction.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about your region here. And I mentioned Lordstown. That plant is chained. Well, I mean, it's what is going on over there? Because I know some businesses were trying to revitalize it. There's battery production now. And talk to me about that part, David.
Well, when the facility closed, obviously we were in a really strange place because the corporation didn't literally close the plant. When they announced they called it an unallocated, right? They were going to unallocate our plant, which really put our members in a tough place because they had no closure, right? There was, mm-hmm. It wasn't like, okay, we're closing the plant. This is what you have to do. Oh, and by the way, when they do close a plant, there's language in our national contract that open up a special bag of, you know, things, training, transfers, early retirements, MSR, stuff like that. Our members didn't get that because the corporation, I think, were skirting their obligations by unallocating the plant. And we're still fighting that. I mean, there's an arbitration case that's still... We're still trying to get some resolve on that 4 years later. So it's been a difficult process. Currently, I mean, after we all left, Lordstown Motors went in there and somehow purchased the place for peanuts, like $20 million or something, which is the tax bill on that facility. So, yeah, right. And then I don't think Lordstown Motors is doing real well with their pickup truck. Foxconn has now moved in, and I see they're building tractors and maybe trying to get some other electric vehicles in that facility. But I mean, look, it's not sitting empty. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we wanted to see GM stay there and you know, build a world class quality car like we always have, but that just wasn't in the cards.
I hear you. I understand there was a strike recently in your region. This was in Holland, Ohio, which is not too far from Toledo, a company called Clarios. Can you fill us in on what happened there?
Yeah, Clarios, the management team there had cut their wages, not specifically their pay, but it's piece rate, so the formula to figure out, you know, on how many parts you make and how much you get paid. They changed it two times in 6 months, essentially lowering the workers' wages there. And they tried to implement a 12-hour with no overtime work schedule. And we're just not moving on any of that. So, you know, the locally elected bargaining committee, my reps out of the region sat me down and it kind of, you know, we go through all this stuff. They said, look, we got to take these people out. And look, nobody wants to go on strike. It's right. Not cost effective for our members, for the union, for the company. It's really a last resort. So when you see a union going out on strike, I hope the general public recognizes that this isn't something that we want to do. It's something that we need to do to gain the justice and dignity for our workers.
Now, they were on strike for 6 weeks. Did we make any progress as a result of that strike? I mean, where are we right now?
Yeah, so they got some increased wages. Benefits have remained the same, so there's no increase in any of those costs. They but also the 12-hour work schedule, which was the big thing, the company finally backed off of that. So okay. It was sad that we had to go through all that. And then the corporation just didn't want to sit down and talk. I mean, weeks would go by and they're like, yeah, we got phone calls, but they won't sit down and bargain with us.
Yeah.
That stuff's frustrating because, look, we all want to sit at the table. I've been in negotiations, man. You lock the door, put on the coffee and hammer it out. Right.
Right.
They just didn't want to do that. And so it drug on for a bit. But I think those members finally passed an agreement that they're good with. I think they got some they have a better contract than they did before. And they're all back at work now.
You know, you're in a tough position. Your union is in a tough position because we're in that transition. You know, batteries, electric vehicles. I know electric vehicles don't have as many components as far as assembly goes. And obviously, you want these plants to be unionized. I know that's coming from the top of the UAW. That looks like a big struggle going forward. How are you prepared for that right now, David?
Well, we're actually preparing our members and have some contract campaigns going out. We've got folks from the international that are going to be reaching out to locals, kind of preparing them for what we're doing, why we're doing it, getting ready, making sure they're prepared for a strike. Obviously, we've got the big thing on the plate right now is Ultium, right? Ultium's in Lordstown. It's in the backyard of the old assembly plant. EV, they're making the lithium ion batteries there. Very dangerous work. Some of these chemicals we can't even identify. OSHA can't regulate because they don't even know what they are yet, right?
Yeah.
Dangerous workplace. They've voted to join the UAW, so we're actively in negotiations there. And the hope is that we can get them under the master agreement. But those are GM jobs. Is our opinion, and we would like to see those workers paid a fair wage. I mean, right now they start at about $16 an hour. It takes them 7 years to get to $20 an hour, and they're just not going to be able to retain any kind of solid workforce with that kind of pay and incentive package. So we're going to actively bargain, and that's a big one for us because it's the first, right, EV battery manufacturing with an ion battery manufacturer that has voted to join the UAW. And so, it's imperative that we get it done right. I'm more concerned about getting it done right instead of trying to get a contract fast.
I hear you. 7 years to get to $20 an hour. Did I hear that correctly?
That's sad, isn't it? And so you got to recognize that these companies are receiving billions of dollars, right, from the government to create these new plants and build this new technology in the country, and then our members are needing government assistance because a family of four, they're living in poverty. So it's just unacceptable, and we're going to fight until we get those people what they deserve.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, that's
our job.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, David Green. He is the Region 2B Director for the United Auto Workers, national website, UAW.org, UAW.org. I encourage you to go to that website if you're in the market for a new vehicle. And I'm hearing from the dealers that they're starting to pick up on inventory. We had some problems with the chips and all that. That's finally starting to get back to normal. But definitely, you want a union-made vehicle. There's plenty to pick from right now. David, you take care. Thanks for joining us here. Keep up the fight. You got a lot. A lot going on, and I always say we have to move the needle in the right direction, and I got the feeling you're doing that. Okay, brother?
Hey, I appreciate your time, and my goal is 1% a day. If we work hard and we can move that needle 1% a day, brother, then we're going to leave it better than we found it. So I appreciate your time today, too.
That's what we want. All right, that'll be it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow we'll check in with the Steelworkers and the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.